Wow, we are 4 weeks into breaking down, dissecting the Klingon Federation campaign, war campaign module that we've been having so much fun going into. We're going to continue the conversation to this week. I'm Michael Dismuke. I'm a blogger on Continuing Missions, also a freelance writer for Star Trek Adventures RPG, lead writer on Captain's Log, and so happy to be going into our third year of continuing conversations with Jim Johnson.
Hey, everybody. Jim Johnson. I am the project manager and line editor for the Star Trek Adventures RPG and the Captain's Log solo RPG, both published by Modiphius Entertainment. Lo, these 8 years now. Happy to be the co-host on this show with Michael going into year three, 120 odd episodes strong. And we still have plenty of stuff to talk about. There is so much to talk about. And we are here to talk more about the Federation Klingon War Tactical Campaign Supplement that just came out by Modiphius. It's still on pre-order. It's we are getting so close to the release date, but it's upon us. It's very nearly upon us anyway. So I hope you all are excited about the book and all the cool tools that we've built into it. And we are here with our wonderful panel of writers and developers and designers and everything else. So without more ado, I'm just going to have them introduce themselves and then we'll jump into the topic here. So I will kick it over to the lead writer for the Tactical Klingon War campaign, Al Spader.
How's it going? I'm Al Spader. I've been a freelance writer for Star Trek Adventures for some time. I'm also a system designer for the tactical overlay. I worked with Ivan Sorensen in developing that. Also, Allison Seib and myself put together the Sentience 2D20 role-playing game. So lots of 2D20 stuff in my life. And I'm excited that I got the opportunity to be lead writer on this project.
Awesome. Thank you, Al. Appreciate it. And over to Michael Duxbury.
Hello. Thank you for having me back. I'm Michael Duxbury. I'm a freelance writer on the Star Trek RPG for some other games for Modiphius, including Cohors Cthulhu, for some other companies like Cubicle 7, the Warhammer RPGs. I also self-publish at Seal of Sabad on Itch and elsewhere. I'm also the organizer of the UK Tabletop Industry Network here in the UK.
Super cool. We'll have to talk about that later. All right. And then thank you, Michael. Over to John Kennedy, one of the longtime STA writers who's been with the show from almost the beginning. Not the show, but the book from almost the beginning. So introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm John Kennedy. I've worked on Star Trek since the beginning, Star Trek Adventures since the beginning. I'm really happy that I get to work on so many aspects to the Trek universe. And I work for Renegade Game Studios, where I've worked on My Little Pony and on a Werewolf, and I've worked on a bunch of other game lines.
All right. Thank you, as always. And then finally, not last but not least, just last on the circle here on my screen, Allison Seib.
Hi, I'm Allison. I'm a freelance writer for Star Trek Adventures. I've done some work on several Modiphius properties outside of Star Trek, Dreams and Machines, Fallout, and so on. I have worked with Al on Sentience, which I think Al's already made everyone aware of, so I'm kind of repeating myself. I tend to do that as well. Done some Pathfinder and Starfinder for Paizo. I have developed Shield Maidens for Mongoose, and aside from that, I have done but I also wrote an adventure for Klingon War for Star Trek, and that's what we're talking about now. So yes.
All right, great. Thanks, everybody. Appreciate your intros there. So before I kick it over to Al to start talking in detail about this book, we're just going to kind of set the stage here. We've been talking about a lot of different components of the book. We're now going to talk about the actual campaign part of it, the chapters 4, 5, and 6, all the meaty RP stuff, the full-length adventures and the mission briefs that are contained in this book. So just with that overview of where we're going, Al, I'll kick it over to you to get us started here.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to dig into this. First of all, I want to apologize. Not every writer is here on the panel today. Susan and Tilly Bridges are not here. Andrew Peregrine's not here. And Keith Garrett is not here. So I apologize that they're not on the panel, but we'll try to give a summary of what their work is and what they contributed as well, and hopefully get a hold of them at some other time. So most of you who have checked the product out or have been looking at the product see that little tactical campaign and have been wondering what that means, because it is different, slightly different than like the Shackleton Expanse book, which is a full-on campaign guide. And one of the biggest differences between the two is the layout of the book. So in lots of the publications we've put out so far, you get a chunk of mission briefs, and then you get the campaign itself, mission by mission, and so on and so forth. Well, because of the campaign tactical overlay, the board game-like part of this book, we decided that we were going to lay out the next three chapters to align with the three campaign stages that are in the campaign overlay. So we call that the early war, the mid-war, and the late war. Okay, so chapter 4 will be early war, but chapter 5, mid-war, chapter 6, late war. What we decided to do was, because you're telling your own story with your crew and your ships, that we wanted to make this campaign all about you. However, we did want to set ground it in the fact that this is happening during the Discovery season one timeline, right? So we have these bookends during each of these stages that we call scripted events. So basically major events that have happened to the USS Discovery or the Federation at the time in which you are starting to do different missions in each stage. For example, the very first scripted event is the Battle of the Binary Stars, right? So it's the very first encounter that started the war. The way that the chapter is laid out is you'll have a full-on mission, a bunch of mission briefs, and then another full-on mission. Again, because those mission briefs correlate to turns in the campaign overlay. They can also just be run without using the campaign overlay, just lots of stuff in each chapter. So I guess let's start off before we start digging into the missions themselves. And I'm going to pass it off to each of our panelists. I'll start with Michael, and then you can each pass off to each other.
Which Michael?
There's Michael two of us. Yeah. Just tell you what went through your heads when this was the direction that we were going, that we were trying to present a campaign that is not what happened to the USS Discovery, but this is a campaign for the characters, a parallel campaign. So Michael Dismuke, why don't you start, and then you can hand it off as you go.
A huge challenge. In addition to going back and having to rewatch Discovery to try to figure out what blew up where or who was affected by what event, it was really trying to appreciate all the different ships. Like I thought about, again, Battle of the Binary Stars, all these other ships that showed up. What were they doing? Where were they going? What did they do afterwards? So it was really, I think the first time I watched Discovery, I didn't realize the scope of it. And then this assignment pushed me to zoom out and kind of be like, okay, how badly did this affect the Federation? And like we spoke in an earlier episode, even look at Mbenga and Chapel. That's a whole nother era there. So it was really a challenge that really made it exciting. I was like, oh man, if I could play a group during this era, this kind of would be sadly, tragically cool, you know? So that was a neat challenge.
I'll jump in next. I was really pleased when I saw that this was the direction that was going to be approached for the campaign, that it was going to be tightly focused on what the player characters' crew were doing rather than focusing specifically on the main characters of the TV show. In many ways, the TV show is quite accommodating because just as the war is hotting off, Discovery leaves the universe. And then comes back after a lot of interesting stuff has happened. And within that time period, that's a great place to set a whole RPG campaign in which you can make basically whatever you want happen, so long as what you want to happen is a long, grueling war in which the Federation is slowly pushed back by the Klingons, which doesn't sound like something you'd want, but that's what the campaign is. And I think that it's always more interesting keeping the events focused on what the player characters are going through, even if the events of canon are still stuff that's happening like around them. It means you get to approach the campaign from the perspective of being a part of something so much bigger than yourself, which I think is interesting. I think that produces good roleplay as your characters try to figure out where their agency is and what the impacts of their choices are, even as there are things that are completely beyond their control.
Allison, what was going through your head?
I'm so good at this. I remember to unmute. Yay. I wanted to explore I was given a mission to put together in the late stages of the war. So I wanted to explore how that's going to differ because the campaign is divided into early stage, middle stage, late stage. How is each stage going to be different from the other? You're wanting to see progression because obviously your players are going to want to see how the war is changing around them just as much as how their actions are impacting on it as well. So that was really something that I wanted to kind of dig my teeth into and get a lot out of. I have to say, reading over the manuscript, it sounds so stylish, but yeah, reading over it, it's come together so nice. It really, really has.
John, when you heard that this is what we were doing as far as a campaign goes, I think that you are the historian among us. And I did you write the history part in the Discovery campaign guide? Because I know some of these events that the missions revolve around were originally written about in the Discovery campaign guide way back 2.5 years ago.
Yeah, I wrote most of it. Yeah. I got to work on the brief overlay of the Klingon War in this book, too. And when it comes to the missions, I really like the fact that, as was touched on previously, it focuses on the people who are doing stuff behind the scenes. It's like, obviously, the show focuses on the main actors. So we have the main characters and it's like, oh, we need to go defend this base. And it's all the bridge crew of the Discovery and they're involved with defending this base. But it's nice that we're offering a look behind the scenes where it's like, oh, the Klingons are trying to take this colony. Here's how they're trying to do it. It's not just a general shows up and he's firing a disruptor cannon at it. It's so many wheels in motion. It's so many things you have to do to save it. Can you even save all of the colony? And with all the other missions, it's the same way. And I think that players, I think they're going to really appreciate the fact that there's a huge amount of room to explore, where they can also be heroes on the same grand scale as the bridge crew without having to feel like, well, let's retread episode 309, you know, I'll take on the role of this character. It's more like, no, here's your chance to shine. How are you going to save the day?
You feel when I came to you and said, this is how I think we should lay out these chapters? What was running through your head when we kind of were discussing the mission briefs, mission, like how'd you feel about that?
So there's times when like you need like a big book, like you need like a big description of an event for the people to understand it. But there's also times, especially for those game masters who they like to have the freedom to do what they want. They need like seeing like the brief. They need to know what's going on, how quickly they can jump in. And then they just need the information to get it going. And so I like the fact that with the way this book's laid out, it was able for there to be both things. You know, it's, hey, I want to know more about the war. How does this work? How can I like mine this for details to put into my campaign? But then there's also, I know pretty much about Discovery. I love Discovery. I don't really need people to like hold my hand through it, but I do need a little bit of information. So it's really nice that that there's just room for both.
Yeah, I was thinking a lot about an old Lord of the Rings video game that I played on PS2, where you like followed this group of characters moving along the path of the events. I think it was called The Third Age or something like that. But like, you know, you were in the Mines of Moria when the main crew was there, but you were telling a different story down in deeper levels and things like that. So it's really like this path that we're trying to tell of, these are the canon scripted events. And then your story is kind of weaving in and out, like in just touching here and there. And that's kind of where we went with this. Some of these missions, in fact, that we decided to go with are like single lines that might have been like throwaway lines in an episode, or almost throwaway scenes in like an episode, that we kind of like drilled down on. And I think we went in a very cool direction with it.
Yeah, I think what I appreciate about the structure that we went with and how it all kind of came together is I know a lot of people watched Discovery, and you know, some people didn't love the storyline, right? They didn't love the characters, they didn't love that piece of it, and some people were turned off to it, and that's unfortunate, because if you look at the totality of the story that they're telling, and you go to the next level beyond like what those characters are doing, there's a wealth of material for story, and I think this is just one way to represent it. Is like, you know, there are hundreds of other ships in Starfleet that are doing stuff the same time Discovery is bouncing all over the place doing their thing, and that's their story. But now you've got an opportunity to do a different story using the same source material. So, you know, those of you who don't like Discovery, like, you know, rewatch it, pinch your nose, and like ignore the main high level character stuff that's happening, but then focus on all the little stuff that they're talking about how the war is progressing and how the Federation is just getting hammered left and right, especially when Discovery's gone and then Discovery comes back. Admiral Cornwell drops all kinds of information about how poorly the war is going for the Federation. And like Michael said earlier in the episode, that's meat for us game masters and role play RPGers, is that there is a multi-year campaign. In real time of playing your campaigns with your friends that you could explore just that chunk of time. Right. So Michael, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, I was just saying, sorry I interrupted earlier. It's building on exactly what you and Al and John were just saying. A great practical example of how that affected what got included in the finished product is, I think at one stage, perhaps before I was brought on to write the final adventure for this book, there was some discussion about what the final mission of the campaign was going to be. And the current thinking was that it should be on or near Kronos, because that's where Discovery is. And when I came on, I said, I don't want to set it there because that's where Discovery is. I wanted to take it somewhere completely different so that players could feel like they were the pivotal characters in what happened at the conclusion of that story. So I took it to Earth, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that final adventure when we get later on into the episode.
Yeah, and I just want to make sure everybody knows that if the tactical campaign overlay that we discussed the rules for last week isn't your jam, you can still run through these missions and just do the role-playing part, right? So they are laid out in a way, and you can run through as many of the briefs as you want or as few as of the briefs as you want. You don't have to run them all. Do what's best for your table. Know your crew. Know when they're starting to look like they're suffering some burnout, and try something different, like use a different story or use a different brief that they're not used to.
Michael? Yeah, look at the elements, you know, like I've learned, especially with the Shackleton Expanse campaign guide when that came out, don't focus so much on, well, my characters aren't there. Oh, well, this character couldn't. Oh, this isn't the right year for that. No. Take a look at the puzzle pieces that we put together. And we'll talk about that, especially as I talk about the design of mine without giving too many Easter eggs, how I made it so that you could easily, I'd really went mine with, I wanted to easily be able to port it anywhere in the universe. So make sure people, as we go through this, you know, we talk about that aspect.
Excellent. So let's get right into, let's start with chapter four. So chapter four starts with the incidents at Corvin 2. And I believe, John, you wrote this mission. So can you let us know what you were thinking when this was the mission that opened up to you? And what were some of the wartime things that you wanted to include as you were telling the story?
So it's one of it comes from like one of the cooler visual moments of Discovery. In the episode that's leading up to it, you know, they're having trouble getting there. They need to activate the spore drive to get to the planet. And, you know, there's that time crunch. We hear it in the background, and we learn that this colony is like the main source of the lithium. It's the largest lithium source for the Federation. And if it gets knocked out, their war efforts crippled, because Starfleet is still building tons of ships after they lost them all at the Battle of the Binary Stars. And they need this dilithium. And the cool visual element, by the way, is when Discovery arrives and just literally ports down and just shoots all the Klingon ships, which is honestly one of my favorite things in the series. But the thing that I really liked about this mission was the fact that it really it helps show like ground level at the beginning of the war. Like it starts off with the Federation has been losing. The Federation has lost on so many fronts. It hasn't lost Starbase One yet, but this is when the Federation's got like a black eye and a bloody nose and doesn't know if it's going to keep in the fight. And I really wanted to help with this mission with portraying the desperation of the Federation, how Federation citizens are being given phasers and told to go and defend, you know, the trenches. And I also wanted to show how the Klingons are not just like a monster that shows up that just wins. I wanted to show like how they would try to win. And I know Klingons say they love honor, and it's been touched on like later in like all the different like, you know, series of the show. But I wanted to show how for a race that culture that prizes honor, how they would be sneaky. Because a lot of people tend to think that if you're super honorable, you'll never sneak, you'll never backstab, you'll never cheat. And the truth is, if you look at history, and I'm a history major, samurai were prone to sneaking, the Vikings were prone to sneaking. Being able to trick your opponent was considered like one of the, you know, the pinnacle things you could do. And so I wanted to include like the Klingon commandos, which if you've watched Deep Space Nine, that's generally what they would, you know, what they're known for. Sorry, I have a very loud Sheltie in the background. But yeah, I wanted to portray not only how the Klingons would assault a target, but how the Federation has to deal with sneaky Klingons.
Yeah, I want to talk about the construct of, I read through the whole mission that you wrote, John. Excellent job making it tactical, because I felt just reading through the module tension, because you made it like this ultimate gated challenge where this has to work on this side of the base for this to work here. And I felt like I was running around with the characters on it. So my highlight on this one, even if you're not playing on Corvin, is look at the design build of how to create a very intense linear gated challenge in a tactical scenario. I felt like a squad leader reading it. It was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, you pull Klingons out of this and you put Cardassians in place of them, you can very easily adapt this mission to any planet, you know, during the Dominion War and whatnot. So really, really excellent job there. I feel like one of the things that it can happen in here is you can be successful on some fronts, but not successful on other fronts. And I love that. And I think you're going to see that that's a common thread on a lot of these missions that you guys did independently of each other. So I'm really excited about that. You'll will notice at the end of the mission, there has been something called campaign impact that has been added. So if you are using the tactical overlay to play along with the campaign, you can earn assets for that based off the different things that you do. You can also lose assets based on that as well. And you'll see that with every mission brief and every full-on mission in each chapter, they have this campaign impact embedded. So we get into the mission briefs, and I'll just quickly go over how the mission briefs are laid out. You know, tip my hat to everyone that had a part in them. I know Michael Duxbury, there's a couple in there that I know that you submitted early on that are really, really fun. There's a suggested era of play, which would be, period of play, which is it early war, mid war, late war, can very easily be adapted. A suggested point of interest type. So if you're playing the campaign overlay and someone flips a tactical point of interest and they would rather role play instead of assign their assets to it, this mission brief can be the thing that they role play while they're doing the campaign overlay. So it's interchangeable there. And you'll notice that each section of the campaign has two mission briefs of each point of interest type. So you can choose between the two. They're usually different scenarios that would focus on different things. So if you're starting to experience burnout or whatnot, you can try something different. So you get two explorations, two tacticals, two what we call routine mission briefs, and then two unknown mission briefs, because there is one thing in the campaign overlay where ships might have to respond to a distress signal and they might not know anything about what's going on there. So these are some things that could happen at that point of interest should people choose to role play. So I did a lot of them here in the first chapter. We also, Michael Duxbury wrote a couple that are spread out throughout the chapters. This is where I don't know if anybody else on this panel got a chance to write any, but I know Tilly and Susan did, I think, 10 of these briefs for us. So they did a spectacular job really looking at from a character point of view at these. So we end the first campaign stage with the sarcophagus ship being destroyed. That major, major blow to the Klingons. Then we move on to the mid-war. Then we move on to the final mission, which was written for early war, which was written by Andrew Peregrine, called Scavenging Pavo. Because it's a war, the Klingon ship was destroyed. That Klingon ship has the ability to cloak. So why wouldn't we send someone to try to steal that cloaking technology during the war? I think that was the concept that Andrew and I had discussed when they put this mission together. So, parts of, the ship have fallen down to the surface of Pavo, and the players get to go down and do some exploration and try to find a cloaking device for their ship, which I thought was a really great idea.
Yeah, and once again, a totally adaptable idea to any era, any time frame of scavenging a crash ship.
Yeah, and that wraps up the first stage of the campaign. The second stage is when, as Michael Duxbury mentioned earlier, is where Discovery disappears, right? It goes away to another universe. Now the war unfolds and things start to get really, really bad. So the first mission there is written again by Keith Garrett. And it's all about one of the things that they mentioned. I forget who said it, but it might have been Admiral Cornwell said that they got to explore the wreckage of the Discovery, right? Because everybody thinks the Discovery was destroyed. They don't know that it transported to the Mirror Universe, or it exchanged positions with the Mirror Universe version. So again, we are going to a space wreckage, and now we're trying to salvage the spore drive, right? That's a very important asset. So why wouldn't we go try to salvage the spore drive? Why wouldn't the Klingons be trying to salvage the spore drive? And that's kind of what that mission's all about. And again, the mission briefs are laid out in the same way as in the first stage. And then we get to the end. The final mission for stage two was written by Michael Dismuke, and it has to do with that picture that's floating behind him. So Michael basically said to me, he's like, I need to write this. I need to write these characters. And it's all about the Khankri. So Michael, do you want to go into a little bit of detail on that?
Yeah. So. One of the things that terrifies me when writing, just so everyone knows, you want to know the scariest thing about writing for Star Trek Adventures, is upsetting the canon, people. So this, you know, since Discovery, the war is so well documented, it's canon, it's alpha canon. I was like, when I was looking through all the episodes, like, what can I touch on that I'm not going to blow up the universe? And I was fascinated in this scene with the Khankri. They were in Discovery very briefly. It was when Cornwall, right before she got abducted, and these characters were killed, and there's nothing said about them more than just their name. I was like, oh, well, this is it then, because I can now create a module that's adaptable to any era. You could swap out the Khankri if you're in a different part of the galaxy. But one of the coolest things, which I had never done before, and Jim actually let me do, was he let me write an art brief. So I'm not sure if anybody here knows how the art gets made, but someone conceptualizes the art on paper in Microsoft Word. We write it. We go onto the internet. We pull in references. So I'm going to share this on Continuing Missions later. Once the book is out, I'm actually going to put my art concept on there. And it became this beautiful piece of art. Jim, do you have the name of the artist right offhand? I don't know if that's...
Keep talking. Give me a second. I'll find
okay.
it.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know if anyone notices too. I put a little Easter egg in there because the name of the module is called Shape of War. And so what I wanted to do, I said, let's dive into geometry as the world building for this. I'm just going to go purely into geometry, find all these different type of shapes and build encounters and challenges just based off geometry. And so what the main character is holding in her hand there, which my piece of reference, just so you know, was the Red Skull in Captain America, the first Avenger holding up the Tesseract. That was my reference on that. If you look forward, that's an icosahedron. It's a 20-sided dice she's holding there. So I thought that would be a cool, you know, Easter egg to put in the book, Al, in the art brief. And the story, again, goes into who are the Cancri? How did they react to the Klingon setting them up to be the area for assassin, you know, for after their characters were assassinated? What was their structure like? What's their culture like? And it was just really exciting to write. And it's a piece where the success in this story is based on the Federation reestablishing positive relationships with the Cancri, which are neutral and isolationist, but hold a key strategic position during the war. And so it behooves Starfleet to go and try to repair that incident there. But it's pretty exciting and a lot of geometry in it.
Yep. And the artist on that piece is Justin Usher. Just for those of you who are curious and want to go hire him and get him to do more artwork, Justin Usher is a freelancer that we've been using quite a bit recently.
I'll have to really send a personal thank you to him.
We need to get an episode of just several of the artists on board and just like dig through their heads, because
I love that,
especially all of this new art in this book. They really over delivered. It's pretty awesome. So
that's good. Yeah. We should in fact call it from concept to finish or something. We should have an episode where we bring in the art briefs, show them, and then show the final and how they develop through layers, through line art all the way through. That would be a really good idea.
Wrote it down, writing it down right now. All right. So that brings us to the late war, which is when the Discovery comes back to, our universe. And lots of things have gone very poorly. We see this big graphic of all the space that the Klingons have pushed into. We learn about some major attacks on star bases all along the border, all along the Federation border. And that's where we get to our first mission of the late war, which is the siege of Starbase Epsilon 12, written by Allison Sibes. So, Allison, what were you thinking when you came up with this? And what type of things were you trying to do with this mission?
Yeah. So this is where we kind of where the mood of the discussion is going to go a bit down. During military conflicts, civilians do get targeted. It happens. It's a thing, and Starfleet and the Federation primarily understand the importance of humanitarian aid. Of protecting people who are being subjected to military attacks, we'll say. That's the main theme I wanted to kind of touch on and bring to the foreground in Siege of Epsilon 12. We have a civilian non-military starbase which is under attack by the Klingons. Your ship, that's the player's ship, is sent to provide aid. It's a mix of military defense and rescue. You are there on a humanitarian mission. I also kind of wanted to kind of sneak in a no-win scenario. You say the words no-win scenario in Star Trek, you immediately think the Kobayashi Maru training situation. If you say to a player, your character is going to be doing the Kobayashi Maru training situation, first thing the player is going to think is, does my character know that it's a no-win situation? Is there a way that my knowledge as a player can influence what my character's knowledge of that is if they do? Everyone wants to kind of win the no-win scenario. This one, I kind of wanted to make it as difficult as possible because there's 600 civilians on the station. And I think the win condition for the mission was to rescue about 200. It's about the cost of war. It's about the value of life. And that's something I really wanted to emphasize with this one. There are a couple of moments where you are dealing with like rescuing big groups of people, and the human mind has a way of like struggling to recognize large numbers, numbers in the terms of like hundreds. If you say like there's been a military assault, seven people were killed, it's like your mind can understand that. You knock that up to like into the hundreds, and the mind just can't really process that. You kind of struggle to. So it's something that I wanted to provide as a challenge equally to the characters, but also for the players as well, to kind of to pause and think of the themes that we're discussing here. It was a tricky one to write, and hopefully I got the theme across with it. But you know, the other players, you'll be able to see what you think of it as well.
Something I thought was so striking about this mission when I was reading it myself is the push your luck element, because obviously you want to stay and save as many people as you can. But the longer you stay, the more you leave yourself at risk to reprisals from your attackers, the greater the chance that you save no one, the greater the chance that and that kind of... It very quickly, I think, will force players in situations where they have to make quite cynical calculus, which is appalling, because you have to literally be trading the value of lives against one another. And that's an astonishingly intense situation to roleplay. And I think it will produce very memorable game sessions.
I really hope so. Yeah, I really hope that that everyone will kind of take something away from it, and it'll kind of... remain an experience that the players will think back on afterwards. There is a couple of like small kind of submissions that I've kind of worked in as well. There's like where there's one NPC who the players are like called to help, and if I remember right, there's like a couple who've been separated in the mission, during the assault, and the players are like, you know, can you help this one NPC while you're also struggling with everything else that's going on? And that's the challenge of like this humanitarian mission. Some of the things that I wanted to touch on with it. Hopefully the players will find it quite works for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And just pointing out again, this again could be the Romulans, right? Like we could make this exact scenario part of the Romulan War. Maybe it's not a civilian starbase, maybe it's an Andorian starbase, we tried to make these all as portable as possible. Sure, we are tying it to events from Discovery, but if you want to run a war of a different type, pull the Klingons out, replace them with someone else, and you've got that scenario. So I really want to emphasize that you're capable of doing that, and we want you to. Like that's why we did this.
Yeah, I want to add too, if you're playing TOS SNW era, this could also be a flashback to a career event. You could do just like season 2 of SNW showed the flashback with Chapel and Benga. So, you know, there's free the brain, like don't get so stuck in the era and all that. Look at the elements of the campaign, the stories that are being told, and be like, ooh, I can adapt that. And to me, you know, where again, our group, we rotate through GMing. I'm constantly looking for ways to readapt this where it's not recognizable. Even and maybe some of the players will be like, wait a second, you know, but overall we've been able to do that with so many of these different modules.
Yeah, and if you're looking to play in the Lost Era or something like that, maybe you didn't get a chance to play this mission with your character, but maybe this could be your Wolf 359 like it was for Sisko, right? So you could use this mission as the thing that is starting you off. Like maybe you're a grizzled vet that was a part of this, or maybe you were on the ship and had to make this awful decision. Like, you know, there's just so much potential. It was very well done.
Not to riff on it, but I mean, if you want to do early next gen, right, this could be, you could drop this right into the Cardassian border wars, right? You know, O'Brien had a military combat experience too, and you know, why not have this on the border, and the Cardassians attacked an outpost or something, and you just shift it wherever you need it. So yeah, great comments, everyone.
And that brings us to there are, again, your 8 mission briefs here that you can play as many of or as few of as you'd like. And then it brings us to the final mission of the campaign. And I don't want to get into super spoilers, Michael, but if you want to kind of give us your mindset, you already started to a little bit earlier. There are a couple of things that when I read this, I was cheering for when I read through it. So what was going through your mind, and what sort of stuff should players expect if they were to play this this mission?
For sure. So the final mission of the campaign is called The Dying of the Light. It's where a lot of the themes of the campaign and of Discovery Season 1 about how much this war will cost the Federation, not just practically, but ethically, really comes to a head, hence the title. Also has a lot of very angry people in it, so I guess it's about rage as well. But the central concept is that this is preparation for the final battle of the Klingon War. The Klingons are coming for Earth this time. Discovery is over somewhere else doing something that you don't know about, so you don't know what the impact of that is going to be. As far as your characters are concerned, this is the final battle to protect Earth. Earth, you know, all things considered, generally gets through most events of the Star Trek canon kind of okay. There are only a handful of times which Earth itself is put on the front line of the conflict. Although I seem to find them quite a lot myself. The final mission of Starfleet Academy, I also attacked Earth. So I guess I just have a grudge against Earth or something. But the concept of this campaign is it's a big battle. Events occur, which you'll probably be familiar with from watching Discovery Season 1 and how that war ends. And then it is about the immediate aftermath of that decision. And it is designed in such a way to, again, reflect the themes of Discovery Season 1. In this case, a very, very pivotal choice that is made early in Discovery Season 1 and give players a chance to make that decision for themselves. I touched on this a bit in a previous episode. One of the challenges for this final mission was the matter of stakes, because this is set within the established continuity. The way in which the war begins and then the middle of the war and the way the war ends is defined by that canon. So players aren't making the choice of players aren't playing to win the war. There's no risk of the players losing the war. It's about what the war is going to cost them. And so I designed the adventure to be specifically about all the things that they had accrued over the course of the campaign that were personal to them and how that was going to be at stake in the finale. So all of the assets that you accrue during the overarching campaign, all of the campaign momentum and progression points and everything else, I wanted to bring as much of that as I physically could into the final scenario so that you were rewarded for your successes and felt the cost of your failures. I wanted to give people a chance to make in this one moment everything happening at the strategic level and everything happening at the roleplay level as integrated as I possibly could, to give the opportunity for that ship that's been tearing it up in the strategic session to suddenly come in and rescue you and have their big damn hero moment, or for you to risk it being destroyed so that your characters, the main characters of your series, can continue. So that was really pivotal for me, making sure that the consequences of the campaign, the whole, are arrived at in this finale. And on that note, I was also bringing in as much as I could from the previous mission briefs and previous adventures that all led up to this moment. John was talking earlier about Klingon commandos attacking Korvan II. The Klingon commandos from Korvan II show up in this scenario, unless you killed them in that scenario. And if they are alive and you beat them in Korvan 2, they're really angry. Commander Lasan, who is the commander of Starbase Epsilon 12, the adventure that Allison wrote and was talking about earlier, Commander Lasan shows up in the final mission if you saved her. So it's a chance for you to feel as though, again, heading off the perception that you don't have agency, that your choices don't matter, that you're in some way secondary to what the main cast of Discovery are doing. Now, your choices do matter. Your choices determine who lives and who dies, and you're on a massive scale. And your choices impact what the future of this universe is going to be beyond the end of the war. It's going to be deciding what the shape of the peace is going to look like and how many more people are going to die or be displaced or suffer life-threatening injuries as a consequence of the decisions you make in that moment.
Yeah. So let me just start off by the very first page of this mission says the GM starts with 3 threat per character instead of the traditional 2. Right. So that right there is making things more intense, more stressful, et cetera, et cetera. And then, like you said, when I got to the scene 2, the mustering role, and I saw that you were bringing in everything from the tactical campaign, like it really felt to me, and then characters from the previous missions, it kind of like felt like our own little Avengers Endgame moment. You know what I mean? Like when all the portals start showing up, opening up, and then everything that you've done over the course of the campaign comes into play here. And I thought it was masterful, Michael. And I can't wait to have the opportunity to actually play it someday.
Oh, I want to add to it too. If I would have known, Dexter, you know, I always get on you about how well you craft your campaigns and your mission. You know, since you've had me since Ghost Rider, you know, but if I would have known you were doing that, I would have had an encounter in here where the Cancrete, if you had successfully formed an alliance with them. And so this is for people listening and GMs out there, that they come in with one of those Avenger through the portal saves, because I do talk about how they have quick hit ships. They have fast, evasive, agile ships that even the Klingons can't get around. That would have been so cool to have them come in for one of those Doctor Strange portal moments. So good. So GMs, listen to that. Take Michael Duxbury's idea and run with that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I do appreciate, and Al mentioned this briefly, is that you did take advantage of tweaking the threat amount for Game Masters at the beginning. We've only done that, I think, once or twice in the entire line. I think the mission finale in the Shackleton book had 3 threat per player character, just because the stakes were so high and it was the big culmination of everything that was happening. I would love to do that strategically in some of our standalone adventures, like where if we do a standalone adventure, we amp up the stakes and then even go the opposite direction. Maybe we do a lighthearted episode where you have 1 threat per character instead of 2, you know, just to play with that. I think that's a lever that we haven't really played with much in the game itself. And so I appreciated that you were intentional about, you know, just turning that dial up a little bit to say, okay, yeah, this episode isn't just, you know, another episode. This is big stakes. And we're really, really glad to see that happening.
Thank you. Yes, absolutely. Having an opportunity to really put players through the ringer is what I wanted to go for. It's also, you know, somewhat mitigated because you can benefit from all the resources you've been getting on the campaign scale that can potentially bring in some additional momentum and determination, which can somewhat balance that out. But mostly I want to make things as painful as possible. I'm sadistic that way.
And also non sequitur, Michael, I am a Shakespeare nerd. So I appreciate the references to Shakespeare that you sprinkled in here as well in the headers and stuff. So you guys, yeah, I mean, spoiler warning for the writers out there who are working with me, you find a way to fold in some Shakespeare, you got me.
It feels like it's a missed opportunity in a Star Trek adventure to not get at least 1
right.
Shakespeare reference in, right? So yes, glad you appreciate it.
Yeah, without going into too much spoiler, there's a lot of people who say, you know, Discovery is not Star Trek. Like, it doesn't feel like Star Trek to them. And I've got to say, Michael, the end of Act 2, the beginning of Act 3 is so very Star Trek that like I was cheering when I saw this. And it reminded me of some scenes from famous sci-fi shows that I've seen in the past. So excellent job there. Here's what I'd like to do. We're getting close to wrapping up and moving on to our gratitude. So let's pass it around to everybody one more time. I'll send it off to you and give your idea, your overview, your over thoughts on the campaign in general and the story that we're trying to tell. So we'll start with John Kennedy. What do you think?
All in all, I think everybody did tremendous work. This is a really good book. And for people who like the show and who really want to know more about the Klingon War, this is a great guide for it. And also it provides room for people to go their own way. And my gratitude is just to everyone else who just reading their stuff, because we all did this collaboratively. And so being able to see how the commandos I put in get to either live or not live later on in the campaign, that was just really wonderful. So being able to work with such talented people is great. And also, I just really like the fact that especially for my section, we had to talk about what the Federation is like during war. And the Federation, you know, had an economy at that time and how it dealt with like the lithium and how it dealt with trying to turn Starfleet from a scientific organization into an army. And really just thank you to everybody who didn't mind me messaging them late at night being like, hey, I want to put this in my section, but I don't know if it fits. Does it fit in your section? And I just think we all did a great job.
Awesome. Awesome. One thing that I do want to touch base on too, John, is these are all told primarily from the Federation perspective, right? Because it is through our lens on the television that this is the Klingons are the bad guys, the Federation are the good guys. As we get to know Klingons and their cultures and whatnot, we believe that, you know, it becomes known that they're kind of misunderstood. And once we understand their culture, it becomes a lot easier to understand why the Klingons are reacting this way to Starfleet. So if you're running a Klingon campaign, you can easily adapt this to play the other side. We've got NPCs in here for you. We've got like you can take these events and turn them on their side and just put a little bit of a different perspective on that. And I think that would be a really cool thing to try.
In a parallel universe, there's somebody who wrote this book completely from the Klingon perspective. So it's like brave Klingon warriors behind enemy lines destroying that evil Federation.
There is a section in Chapter 2 specifically with ideas for how you can do that, specifically about how to approach this campaign from a Klingon perspective and how that affects the material I've got. Also for approaching it from like a third party trading war profiteering perspective. I really enjoyed, you know, it being able to write about how, yeah, the same events can be very different from seen from two different points of view.
Yeah, and the Klingons and independents, like civilians or independent merchants, whatever, they're not immune to the traumas of war, right? So that whole subsystem of rules, you can easily put that into a Klingon game or into an independent game without a whole lot of difficulty, because like was mentioned earlier, like war impacts everybody, civilian and every side of the war. So don't hesitate to use that stuff no matter what kind of game you're running.
Allison, we'll get final thoughts, then Michael Duxbury, and then we'll move on to our gratitude across the board. So Allison, what are your final thoughts?
Final thoughts. I think it's together. It's a lovely campaign that's been put together, and just all together kind of creates just such a memorable series of stories for your players to take part in. Like we've mentioned earlier, a lot of the main themes of war and conflict are universal. So you can take the elements from the campaign and transpose them into so many conflicts in the Star Trek universe. You know, drag it back 100 years, pop it into the Romulan conflict. chuck it forward 100, 150 more years, put it into the Dominion one, even chuck it forward 10 years and have it onto the conflict with the Gorn, which is ongoing in Stranger Worlds at the moment. There's so much that you can do with it, and I hope that everyone out there enjoys it and gets a lot out of it.
Michael Duxbury?
So I just wanted to say that a lot of what I've been talking about is at a very macro, high-level conflict, talking about how these big set-piece adventures relate to the overarching campaign, which is obviously easy for me to do because I wrote the conclusion of all of that. But as Al has touched on, there's so many mission briefs in this book, which touch on smaller stories that aren't necessarily as pivotal in the war, but I think are still going to be absolutely brilliant standalone sessions even, or side stories in your ongoing campaign. As Al said, I did get to write a few of them, which meant I got to write about themes like refugee displacement, touch on the kind of like subterfuge intelligence side of things a bit as well. I wrote one called Daedalus Waxing, which is kind of like hinting at events that can occur beyond the scope of the campaign with Project Daedalus, and how, you know, the end of one war can easily spin into the next crisis, and the idea that wars start here and end here is basically an illusion. There's a continuity of activity that you have to be mindful of as well. And other writers as well who were covering a lot of those smaller individual moments to approach the perspective of this grand and terrible conflict in a multifaceted way. And I really appreciate that there was room for both the big stuff and the little stuff in this story.
So I'll give a couple of closing thoughts before we go into gratitude and Dismuke. This is the second big campaign kind of book that we've done for the line, right? We did Shackleton Expanse, which was a big, you know, 10-part multi thing. And then we've done like short mini campaigns several times in like Lower Decks and the Tricorder set and so forth. But this is the next big, you know, full-blown campaign we've done with multiple full-length adventures, multiple mission briefs, wealth of information. So I'm really excited that it's just now part of the game canon. I think one of the most exciting pieces of it that I really like, of course, being a game master thinking big, is the page, or I mean, it's really a half a page of what happens next. Like, how do you take all the events from this campaign and spin it off into something else before we even get to the events of Strange New Worlds, before we get to the original series, etc. And gosh, we could have spent pages on what ifs and like how to use this whole campaign as a springboard to what happens next, because like every one of those bullet points that we included or that you all included in that last little chunk of what happens next, every one of those could be blown out into a multi-season campaign. Like I love the one about you know, chasing down war profiteers and pirates, like all those people that were doing bad things during the war that maybe they didn't think the Federation was looking because the Federation was busy getting their butts kicked. But, you know, somebody was keeping track of that stuff. and now it's time to go pay the piper, basically. So there's just so much material in here, which I really appreciate. I mean, we packed it. This is what, a 232 page book, and we packed this thing full of stuff. So I am just grateful to all of you for all the hard work you did on this. So I guess that's my closing words is just remember that this thing is portable to any time frame, any era of play, any adversaries that you want to include. Just swap out the Klingons, drop something else in. You don't have to be tied to the continuity that we've seen on screen. You can move this around if you want. But you know, if you love Discovery, then this fits right in there and you can tell a parallel story to what was happening to the Discovery. So Michael, any last words before we jump into Dismuke, I'm sorry, before we jump into gratitude?
Yeah, my final words is my gratitude, kind of. Again, thank you to all these amazing writers, to Al, to Jim, to Allison for, you know, the concept design, overall concept design on this. I know for myself, I've been wanting to do something really huge in my personal RPG with my personal RPG group, but I didn't really have the structure nor template to make sure it's manageable and understandable at the many levels and depths that a big conflict can be. And this is now my template for that. So thank you all for making my life as GM so much easier. I'll be using a lot of this over the next 2 years. So. Let's do gratitude going around. Let's do Duxbury, Allison, John, Al, Jim. All right, I'll remind you if you forget.
So that's me first, I think. So I'd like to thank the other writers who are putting together missions for staying in touch with me as I was working on my own. I mentioned that I was able to bring back characters from other adventures to be in my final mission. I was able to bring in mechanics from the overlaying campaign into that final mission as well. We were all writing at the same time, or in some cases there was a bit of staggering, so I'm sure it can't have been very convenient to be constantly being pestered by me to say, I need to know how this works, and you were like, well, I don't know how this works yet because I haven't finished writing. But you know, we muddled through and we made it work, which was really nice. I'd also like to express my gratitude to some other like big, long, ongoing campaigns that I've played that were really inspirational to me in terms of what this would look like and what my final mission should look like. In particular, I would like to shout out to the designers and publishers of the game Band of Blades, which was an RPG that I wrote, that I played a couple of years ago, which is a similar big, ongoing military campaign with spotlights in specific locations and specific short adventure seeds, which gave me loads of ideas for what I should be including along the way and for what a big spectacular conclusion to that kind of campaign looks like. So I was really grateful for that. Yeah, that's me.
Allison.
Right, okay. So gratitude to Michael for inviting us all on. Gratitude for your work in everything with the Klingon War campaign. Jim, gratitude for like just bringing us all into Star Trek Adventures as it is. And I would also like to throw a little surprise gratitude out to the group of players I had come along to my Intro to Star Trek Adventures session last weekend, which is probably going to be quite a few weekends by the time everyone hears this. They did absolutely fantastic, really got their teeth into the tricorder intro starter box and had a load of time. And big gratitude to the staff at the Dice Cafe in Portsmouth who provided hosting for us to get a whole bunch of new players into Star Trek Adventures.
All right, I think that's my turn. Again, just a lot of gratefulness to the team and just being able to just feed off of everybody's energy, and especially to Michael Dismute. We were at Gen Con together this past year, and seeing his enthusiasm, especially when everybody that came through, it was like every person who came through the booth was like, you know, he greeted him with the same energy for the first person, the same energy for the last person. And that really shows just how like passionate this whole team is. And being able to work on this has always, you know, it's a delight because I get to tell people like, yeah, I get to look at, you know, economics for the Federation and how a Klingon team could disrupt it. And the average person probably won't care about that, but being able to work with so many like colleagues on an equal footing and have them be like, yeah, that's cool. Have you considered this? Or you're going a little too deep to the pedantic part of this. We got to get Klingons. We got to get Federation. We got to get them to go to war. And it's like, yeah, no, I just love working with everyone. And big shout out to Jim, who really helps with just, you know, with giving me pointers on where you'd like to see things go. And also, to Al. I mean, Al, we've chatted like, you know, a few times. We've always been so great. And I really like seeing your mind at work on this, where this book, you know, just the way it's laid out, you can jump ahead, you can play through just straight through. It's got the room for you to do what you want with it. And I think it's a great asset for any Game Master's toolbox.
I appreciate that. John. And overall, I just appreciate all the work that all the writers have done on this. I think there were 10 or 11 of us total that all put an effort into this. And, you know, that can be a little bit daunting from someone who, you know, is the lead writer. But you guys made it all so easy, you know, like, it's not like I had to chase after anyone to get their work done. It's like, we were super, like, we were emailing back and forth all the time. And so I appreciate all of the writers, that took a part of this, even those, who couldn't, be here, Susan, Tilly, Keith, Andrew, Aaron, we'll hope get you on at some point in time. And I think we'd be remiss in not giving gratitude to anyone here in current day who is serving in the military or who has served in the military for any country anywhere on the planet, because, you know, we all understand, we might not understand what those horrors are, but we know that they impact you in many different ways. And I'm hoping that as we start moving forward as a world culture, that we can see less and less need for having the militaries there. But as for now, I appreciate you either volunteering or going to the front lines, et cetera, et cetera, because, you know, it's not an easy job. And, you know, sometimes you're displacing a family and things like that. So thank you. Thank you so much for all that you have done for your country, for this planet. That's me.
All right. Well, I'm grateful to all of you, of course, for putting this together, and Al for leading the charge, so to speak, bringing in all the pieces. And it just came together so nicely. So thanks to all of you, all the writers who couldn't be here on the show. Thanks to Chris Webb for laying out the book, for Ariel or Aya for the art direction, the fantastic art direction on all the art that's in this thing. It all came together into just, you know, a great presentation. I just love the fact that it's another gigantic toolkit to drop into the world. I mean, heck, we could pull the plug on the game tomorrow, right? Now, not that we will, we're not going to, but I mean, we could pull the plug on the game tomorrow, and there's enough wealth of material in this book and the rest of the line combined. Like, me as a game master, I'm set for the rest of my life. Like, I'm mumble years old, and I've only got so much more gaming in me, but it's all going to be Star Trek, and the Star Trek Adventures is robust enough now that I could happily play it for the rest of my life and still not explore everything that we've brought to the table now. And fortunately, that's not going to happen, because we've got all kinds of new stuff to come over the coming years. So no worries there, but just super grateful for all of you and the entire team at Modiphius and Paramount and CBS Studios who created Discovery, of course, right? Who created Star Trek Discovery, created that storyline with all the stuff going on. And even with the events that were happening on the show, created enough depth that there was so much more material there to work with that I think a lot of people miss, because they're focused on the things they don't like and not appreciating everything else that's there. So hopefully we've given an opportunity to put a lens on that and bring it up, and maybe it'll inspire you to go rewatch the show just to see what's happening with the war and what kind of new things you can fold in to it along with this book. So thanks everybody, and of course thank you to the fans. Don't say it often enough, but without the fans, we wouldn't be doing that. We would not have done this book. We would not still be doing this game after 7 years. And so thank you for supporting each other. Thank you for supporting the game. We love you, and I love you all, and just looking forward to seeing what you do with this amazing toolkit that we've put together for you.
That's right. You're always welcome to tell your short stories. Share your post-play reports on Continuing Mission, which is the fan site for all of us super fans out there. So until next time, the conversation continues. Thank you everyone for being on today. IDIC.
Live long and prosper. Be safe. Be well. We'll talk to you again next time.